The inscription on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial reads, "In honor of the men and women of the Armed Forces of the United States who served in the Vietnam War, the names of those who gave their lives and of those who remain missing are inscribed in the order they were taken from us. 1959, Dale R. Lewis."
I want some of the glory that my dad and uncle had. And I want them to look at me with a little bit of pride and respect, too.
We met as soulmates on Paris Island. We left as inmates from an asylum. And we were sharp as knives. And we were so gung-ho to lay down our lives.
And you pick up a KIA, and you knew that these guys knew this guy. And most of them just turned their back. They didn't even want to see him get on the helicopter. But the ones who did look, I mean, that look stayed in their faces, and that look is ingrained in my brain. I mean, it was just, they really wanted to cry, but they weren't allowed to cry. They weren't allowed to grieve.
Remember Charlie.
Firefly missions, where we went up in the Tainan province and through the fish hook and came back down looking for sampans at night. We had one ship that was light and one ship that was dark, and we'd alternate that. They would shoot at the light ship. I mean, if you got 25,000 candle power beaming down on you, you're going to take a pot shot at it. I don't care who you are. And then the dark ship would come into action. And we alternated that back and forth. 1 week white, light, 1 week dark. You know, gave everybody a fair chance of getting hurt.
Bob Connolly served two tours in Vietnam, first on a medevac helicopter and then as a crew chief on a helicopter gunship. But Bob Connolly has not been able to end the war in his mind. His dreams are filled with the images he's seen. The red-haired boy with the blue eyes killed in action, the black kid with a bandage around his neck who died before Connolly could help him, an image of thousands of orange balls coming at his helicopter one night near Cambodia, each orange ball a shell sent to destroy him. Bob Connolly represents the angry veteran who feels his values were taken from him in a war nobody else wanted to fight or win. Then there's Ken Berez, drafted, trained, and sent to be a rifleman with the 82nd Airborne Division.
Being in Vietnam, I learned what the human body and the mind of a human being can handle as far as stress, fear.
Ken Berez has made his peace, but it was tough. He served a four-month stint in combat. He remembers his first firefight. He and his unit were ambushed at night.
I was trembling afterwards. I was hyperventilating. I was disoriented for that rest of the night and realizing that the life of Ken Berez could have ended right there and then in the middle of some god-awful rice paddy.
Ken Berez came home a paraplegic. His unit was moving in small boats when they were ambushed. Everyone else on Ken's side of his boat was killed. It would be 2 years before he could walk again with the aid of braces. Recently, he stood before the names of the dead at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
This is what war is about, loss of life. Intellectually, I think all of us who served in Vietnam know that. But when you finally see the list of 60,000 names here of killed and MIAs, it hits home.
The memorial is a place where the living can remember the dead and make one more link with them. Before the memorial was finished, a group of combat veterans jumped the fence late one night, and there in the dark they used matches to search for names. The names are arranged in the order they died or turned up missing. The veterans managed to find some names they knew, and there in the privacy of the darkness, these combat veterans cried out their grief. And weeks later, two Marines jumped the snow fence in broad daylight. They walked along the path and looked at the names, and one of them, a captain, reached out and touched a name there on the polished black marble, and for a moment he stared at the ground, lost in thought, and for that moment, that name lived again. Each name once lived, and each name is a memory for somebody. There on the black marble is the great tapestry of America, the names of our heritage. Adams, Iannuzzi, Zelenko, Lopez, Isaacs, Lefebvre, Iyama.
My most vivid memory has lived with me for 12 years. And I have finally gotten to the point where I've learned to live with him.
Linda Van Deventer was an army nurse at an evacuation hospital near Pleiku.
He was a kid who was probably about 18 or 19. He was in a chopper. He was a door gunner, and he was friendly fire. He had a mortar flare explode in his face.
It was nighttime. She was called to duty during an attack on the base. As shells landed with their thumps and booms, she saw the terrible damage that had been done to the young door gunner.
I was really caught short. I really thought I had seen it all at that point, and this kid was something else.
She recalls putting up an emotional wall which helped her perform the necessary nursing functions while the doctors tried to save the young man's life. It went on for a long time, and when it ended, Linda Van Deventer's life had been changed.
I just spent the next 8 hours pumping blood into him. We pumped about 120 units of blood into him. And then finally, after a number of hours of just going around from one point to another, he had four lines running into him. I'd take down a bag of blood, put it back up, take down the next bag, put up a new one, take down the next bag, put up a new one. And finally, at some point in time, I kicked into his fatigues and a picture fell out of his pocket. And it was him and his girlfriend at a senior prom. I figured probably not much more than 6 months earlier. And he was not a case anymore. He became a person. And I was frozen for a minute until somebody called me again for some critical thing, and then the wall goes back up again and you become a robot again. And I went back and I kept doing what I had to do until they finally decided that they just couldn't save him. And I went over to post-op with him after they just dressed his head in these massive dressings, and he was like this big swath of white with blood stains coming through. And I stood with him for another half hour or so. He was conscious. We had not been able to anesthetize him because he would have died from the anesthesia because he was so low in blood. So we had just paralyzed him during the surgery. And I asked him, I held his hand, and I asked him if he had any pain, and he squeezed my hand, and I asked him if he wanted any pain medication, and he squeezed my hand again. So I called somebody over and asked them to give him some morphine intravenously. And I knew it was going to make him die faster because it would slow his respirations. And I didn't care at that point. I wanted him to go. And I wanted him to slip away easily and painlessly. And when he finally stopped breathing, I went back outside and I looked at that picture again. And he was a person. And he wasn't a person anymore. He was lost. And that was a turning point for me. It wasn't a game anymore. It wasn't diplomacy, and it wasn't whether we could take something or take this hill or take that hill. It was the reality of what the war was people dying.
Linda Van Deventer came home with her memories, and eventually she came to an understanding with herself about her experience with the young man in the photograph. And for her, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is more than a cold marble wall.
There was a nurse who was killed the day that I arrived in Vietnam. And so I knew when I found her name and I touched her name that all of the ones for the next year beyond that were mine.
And the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is more than a monument to those who died. It is a symbol that honors all of those who went to fight the war. It can serve as a reminder that some went when called, and some came home to indifference or worse.
I think a lot of people believed all the stereotypes that we were just a bunch of killers and drug addicts, and they didn't want any part of us.
J. Joe Ammond was a combat engineer who felt slighted when he came home, and other veterans say they felt the same way. Some have adjusted better than others. Many are proud of their service. Among these men is Navy Captain Jack Fellows, prisoner of war for more than 6 years.
I served 7 years with a guy I've never met greater. I don't even like to use the word hero because everybody's a hero. Football players, of course, 3 touchdowns, you're a hero. But these guys are something else. And my roommate Ron Bliss and Jerry Coffey and these guys who supported me during this thing. I had guys injured you wouldn't believe. Injuries that they sustained in ejections and in beatings and in torture, who never let that get to them.
But asked what got him through years of captivity, Captain Fellows' first answer was being an American.
It's not going to ever be forgotten. I just hope that we don't stop being Americans and being what we are because of a war that wasn't really the best of our likings.
The dedication of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial does not heal all of the wounds, but former rifleman Ken Berez thinks it's a start.
There's a lot of work yet to be done concerning Vietnam veterans. And maybe it's ironic, and maybe this is a contradiction also, that for so long, those of us who managed to survive the war have been trying to keep alive the memories of those who died. Now maybe it's their turn. Those who did die in the war can serve a purpose in helping those who are still alive.
Perhaps the real meaning of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is best summed up by another veteran, Ben Shapiro, who worked for Army Intelligence near Hue and Da Nang.
I think the bitterness and the divisiveness of Vietnam can now be put behind us. The memorial, when it was designed, was supposed to be non-political. Didn't turn out to be that way totally, but it now allows for people to come and to gather and to honor the dead and to leave a legacy for the living. And I think it's going to take what went on with the return of the hostages and expand it even further and allow people to put it to rest, to put all the divisiveness and the hate and the distrust to rest. And we finally have something that says, welcome home. We wish that the other 57,000 could have come home as well.
The final name on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is Richard Vandegeer. The year was 1975. The final words on the memorial are these. Our nation honors the courage, sacrifice, and devotion to duty and country of its Vietnam veterans. This memorial was built with private contributions from the American people. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial says to those whose names are carved into the marble, we honor you. And it says to Bob Connolly, Ken Berez, Jack Fellows, Linda Vandeventer, Ben Shapiro, and all of the others, welcome home.
In April of 85, that was the 10th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. Can I keep this? That was the 10th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And all the papers were coming out with, Dan will be back.
He's going to get a drink.
All the papers were coming out with articles about the Vietnam veteran 10 years later, Vietnam, a retrospective. And I queried a lot of editors of these papers, because none of the articles really rang true. And I found out that most of the articles had been written by non-veterans. Huh. And it really hacked me off. So I wrote the following. I start out with two biblical quotes. I mean, one should always start out with religion. The first one is from Psalm 38. My heart pounds. My strength fails me. Even the light is gone from my eyes. My friends and companions avoid me because of my wounds. My neighbors stay far away. I'm like a deaf man who cannot hear, like a mute who cannot open his mouth. I've become like a man who does not hear, whose mouth can offer no reply. Do not let them gloat or exalt themselves over me when my foot slips, for I'm about to fall, and my pain is ever with me. And then a much shorter quote from Luke, 20th chapter, verses 46 and 47. beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and love salutations in the marketplaces and the places of honor at feasts to devour widows' houses. Here we go. I begin to worry of the stories of veterans that are now in vogue with the newspapers. The stories that dissect a veteran's psyche as if prying apart a laboratory frog. Patronizing stories written by style section reporters who know all there is to know about chocolate mousse, ladies' fashions, and the wonderful desserts that can be made with simple Jell-O. I worry of seeing veterans analyzed and diagnosed and explained by people who share nothing with veterans, by people who, one feels intuitively, would regard it as a harrowing experience to be alone in a backyard. Week after week, the Moose authorities tell us what is wrong with the veteran. The veteran is badly in need of adjustment, they say. Lacks balance. Needs fine tuning to whatever it is in society that one should be attuned to. What we have here, can't compete. You're bigger than I am. Go ahead and do it. Floyd would say something about that. What we have here, I'll agree, with omniscience and veiled condescension, is a victim. The press loves a victim. The veteran has bad dreams, say the Jell-O writers. Is alienated, maybe hostile, doesn't socialize well. Isn't, to be frank, quite right in the head. But perhaps it's a veteran's head to be right or wrong in. And maybe it makes a difference what memories are in the head. For the Jell-O writers, a war was a moral fable on Channel 4, a struggle hinging on Nixon and Joan Baez and the inequities of this or that. I can't be sure. The veterans seem to have missed the war by having been away in Vietnam at the time and do not understand the combat as it raged in the internecine cocktail parties of Georgetown. It's a fucking landing zone. To me, Vietnam was not what it was to the Jell-O writers. Not a ventilation of pious symbolisms, not the latest literary interpretations of the domino theory. It left me memories that fashion writers can't imagine. It was the slums of Quignon where dogs' heads floated in pools of green water, and 3-inch roaches droned in sweltering back alley rooms, and I was happy. Washington knows nothing of hot, poor, rich, beery Quignon. I remember walking through the bush with a devilish green jungle closing in like a vice and rockets shrieking down from the dim hills to burst around us and crouching behind the dead to treat the wounded. The Moose authorities do not remember this. I remember the unexpected villa with Kaliza, the bawling grunt, Naoki, the crazy freelance combat photographer, and Zoko, the Frenchman, when the night jumped and flickered with the boom of artillery and we listened to Mancini on shortwave and watched Inika dance. Washington's elite did not know Inika. They know much of politicians and of furniture. If I try to explain what Vietnam meant to me, I haven't for years and never will again, they grow uneasy at my intensity. My God, their eyes say. He sounds as though he liked it over there. Something in the experience clearly snapped an anchoring ligament in his mind and left him with odd cravings, a perverse view of life. Well, nothing dangerous, of course, but the war did that to them, they say? War is hell. Well, yes, they may have something there. And you've seen a peasant mother screaming over 3 pounds of bright red mush that, thanks to God in a Chi-Com 107, is no longer precisely her child. Or when you've watched in horror and rage while a friend's life seeped through compresses and your own impotent fingers, you see that Sherman may have been onto something. When you've eaten rice with Arvin troops and charred jungle clearings, when the heat beats down like a soft rubber truncheon, and a wretched stink comes from shallow graves, no particular leap of imagination is necessary to notice that war is no paradise. I cannot say that the Jell-O writers are wrong in their understanding of war, but somehow I don't like hearing pieties about the war from these sleek, wise people who never saw it. It offends propriety. There were, of course, veterans and veterans. Some hated the war, some didn't. Some went around a bend down in Four Corps where leeches dropped softly down collars like green sausages and death erupted unexpected from the ungodly foliage. To the men in the elite groups, the SEALs, Special Forces, Recondos, and LERPs, who spent years in the Khmer Bush, low to the ground where the ants bit hard, the war was a game with stakes high enough to engage their attention. They liked to play. To many of us there, the war was the best time of our lives, almost the only time. We loved it because in those days we were alive. Life was intense. The pungent hours passed fast over the central event of the age, and the howling jets appeased the terrible boredom of existence. Psychologists, high priests of the mean, say that boredom is a symptom of maladjustment. Maybe. But boredom's been around longer than psychologists have. The Jell-O writers would say that we're mad to remember fondly anything about Nixon's war that Kennedy started. They do not remember the shuddering flight of a helicopter high over glowing green jungle that spread beneath us like a frozen sea, and never made the low runs a foot above treetops along paths that led like rivers through branches that clawed at the skids, never peered down into murky clearings and bubbling swamps of sucking, snake-ridden muck. They do not remember monsoon mornings in the bush when dragons of mist twisted and coiled lazily on themselves, puffing up and swallowing whole villages in their dank breath. The moose men do not remember looking before dawn in the blackness and catching ghostly shapes, maybe VC, thin yellow men mushroom-headed in the night, bicycling along the alien roads. As nearly as I can tell, the Jell-O riders did not remember anything. And then it was over. Veterans came home. Suddenly the world seemed to stop dead in the water. Suddenly the slant-eyed hookers were gone, as were the gunships and the wild, drunken nights and places that the Jell-O riders can't picture. Suddenly the veterans were among soft, proper people who knew nothing of what they had done and what they had seen, and who, truth to be told, didn't much like them. Nor did some of us much like the people at home, though it was not at first a conscious distaste. Men came home with wounds and terrible memories and dead friends to be greeted by that squalling she-ass of Tom Hayden's to find a country that viewed them as criminals. Hi, Jane. Slowly, to more men than will admit it, the thought came, these are the people I fought for? And so we lost a country. We looked around us with new eyes and saw that in a sense the Moose people could never understand we'd lost even our dignity. I remember a Marine corporal at Bethesda Naval Hospital who, while his wounds healed, had to run errands for the nurses, last year's co-eds. A hell of a bust, he said, with the military's sardonic economy of language. Machine gunner to messenger boy. It wasn't exactly that we didn't fit. Rather, we saw what there was to fit with and recoiled. We sought jobs, but found offices where countless bureaucrats shuffled papers at long rows of desks like battery hens awaiting the laying urge, their bellies billowing over their belts. Some of us joined them, but some, in different ways, fled. A gunship pilot of my acquaintance took to the law and to drink, and spent 5 years discovering that he really wanted to be in Rhodesia. Others went back to the Death in the Bushes outfits, where the Howard Old rules still held. I drifted around Europe, Africa, Asia, North America, hitchhiking and sleeping in ditches a lot, until I learned that aberrant behavior, when written about, is literature. The Jell-O riders were quickly upon us. We were morose, they said, sullen. We acted strangely at parties, sat silently in corners and watched with noncommittal stares. Mentally, said the fashion experts, we hadn't made the trip home. It didn't occur to them that we just had nothing to say about Jell-O. Desserts mean little to men who have lain in dark rifle pits around Dan Chan in rainy season, watching mortar flares tremble in low-lying clouds that flickered like the face of God, while in the nervous evening, safeties clicked off along the wire and Amtrak's rumbled into alert idles, coughing and waiting. Once, after Saigon fell, I came out of a saloon in Washington, D.C., saw a veteran with a sign on his jacket. Vietnam. If you haven't been there, shut the fuck up.
I wonder who that was.
Maybe, just maybe, he had something.
I know, exactly.
That's rusty.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's rusty.
You got